Part C. In this part of the test, you'll hear two different extracts. In each extract, you'll hear health professionals talking about aspects of their work. For questions 31 to 42, choose the answer A, B, or C, which fits best according to what you hear. Complete your answers as you listen. Now look at extract 1. Extract 1, questions 31 to 36. You hear a presentation by a specialist cancer nurse called Sandra Morton, who's talking about her work with prostate cancer patients, including a man called Harry. You now have 90 seconds to read questions 31 to 36.
My name's Sandra Morton and I'm a specialist cancer nurse, helping cancer patients deal with their diagnosis and treatment. I'd like to tell you about the type of work I do, and particularly about one of my patients, recently diagnosed with prostate cancer. Let's call him Harry, to illustrate the sort of things I get involved with. Now, before we get on to Harry, I'll give you a bit of background. Clearly, my job covers many aspects of patient care, but what's the priority? Firstly, prostate cancer is in fact the most common cancer in men in the UK, with over 40,000 new cases diagnosed every year. That's a staggering number. One problem is that this type of cancer actually develops very slowly, so there may be absolutely no sign that you have it for years. So, if we're going to reduce the number of cases, it's vital that people like me get the word out to as many men as possible, that we tell them how to spot the signs of prostate cancer, like an increased need to urinate or straining while urinating. Unfortunately, the cancer can be at an advanced stage by the time patients come in for tests, at which point the available treatments are far less effective. So, let me tell you a bit more about my patient Harry. Like many middle-aged men, Harry was offered a routine health check at his local doctor's surgery. As far as he was concerned, he had no particular health problems or obvious symptoms at the time, and so he almost ignored the invitation. But he'd promised his family he'd look after himself. His wife had died of ovarian cancer some years before, so he felt obliged to go. It was during his appointment that, based on a few symptoms he mentioned, Harry's doctor decided that he'd need further investigation for prostate cancer and referred him to a specialist clinic at the hospital. Harry's trip to the clinic started with a routine blood test, which initially showed a slightly low haemoglobin level. A further test then revealed that his PSA, the prostate-specific antigen, was high at 20. He then saw a urology consultant who conducted a digital rectal examination and biopsy, a procedure that I always try to explain to patients may be uncomfortable but is entirely necessary. In fact, though, Harry said the three-week interval between having a biopsy taken and hearing the outcome was far more of an ordeal. Harry told me that when he went to see the consultant to get his results, he immediately sensed he was in trouble. Although the consultant was very considerate in delivering the news, unfortunately, the indications were that Harry did indeed have prostate cancer. He was assured that the cancer was low grade and not aggressive. Harry had suspected the worst, and though he'd tried to prepare himself for it by doing some online research, finally hearing that confirmation was still a shock. In fact, the very mention of the word sent Harry into panic, which was very unlike him. So at the time I first met him, he was very vulnerable and grateful to have someone to talk to. Of course, the response to the illness amongst prostate cancer patients like Harry can vary enormously. I've dealt with some men, for example, who haven't really realised the importance of keeping up their medication because they've felt relatively well, especially if they've been experiencing unwanted side effects. Unfortunately, though, any break gives the disease the perfect opportunity to spread into the bones, making it much more difficult to treat and a successful outcome less likely. And some treatments do cause some unfortunate effects, such as erectile dysfunction, which some men really feel uncomfortable discussing, because it's a sensitive issue. Other patients have mentioned that even though they've been given a lot of help, it's still difficult to weigh up the pros and cons of the various treatment options they're offered, from ultrasound or radiotherapy right through to radical prostatectomy. So responses like these need to be taken into account by specialist nurses when talking to patients. For me, these factors really underline the importance of the community follow-up clinics we have in my area, which address many of these issues in the provision of healthcare for cancer patients. Staff at these clinics see patients during their recovery and only send them back to hospital for treatment if they develop significant new symptoms. Seeing patients in the clinics means that staff get to know each patient and build a relationship with them, which enables nurses like me to dispense advice and answer questions. And although we have no firm evidence, staff feel that's far more beneficial to patients than attending a large hospital clinic. So we're hoping more clinics like these can become available.
Now look at Extract 2. Extract 2, questions 37 to 42. You hear a neurologist called Dr. Frank Madison giving a presentation about the overuse of painkillers. You now have 90 seconds to read questions 37 to 42.
I'm Dr. Frank Madison, and I'm a neurologist with a special interest in the overuse of painkillers, particularly of opioids, something experts are now calling the silent epidemic. Now, we've all seen the stereotypical images of addicts hooked on recreational drugs, but addiction to painkillers like opioids has a much less familiar public face. From what I've seen, one reason for this is that the range of people affected makes them less easy to pigeonhole. I mean, there's no typical age, social class, and so on. And of course, most people seeking help for opioid overuse were initially prescribed the medication by their own doctors for pain relief. This highlights a major part of the problem. Physicians often pay little attention to the possible risk of addiction. They need to look carefully at patients' personal histories and assess the risk, considering things like depression and anxiety disorders, before prescribing opioids. In recent years, there's been a dramatic increase in opioid prescriptions. I see a pattern not just of GPs over-prescribing, but of GPs inappropriately prescribing. Sure, people want their pain relieved immediately, that's understandable, but proper pain management requires lengthy face-to-face input, which time pressures don't allow, so easier alternatives have become the default option. What's more, although opioids can provide effective relief in the short term, they shouldn't be the automatic first-line therapy. Many alternatives do exist, and they're no more costly. People generally think of pain as a direct symptom of a problem in the affected area. But pain is an extremely complex subject, and it's one that used to be underrepresented in medical education. Thankfully, that's no longer the case, and doctors now realise that when a patient complains of acute back pain, that pain may not be due to a clear and treatable disease, but that such pain often presents in people with other medical problems, and these need investigation. Although there are distinct types of physical pain, all too often I see sufferers lumped together in one category, which means that unfortunately not all treatments are going to work equally well. For example, we first need to know, is the pain caused by inflammation as opposed to nerve damage? Establishing this makes initial mistreatment far less likely, meaning that treatment is more effective and the risks of long-term problems are reduced. But it's not just opioids we need to watch. Patients often self-treat with readily available painkillers like paracetamol. And while such drugs play an essential role in pain management, people still need to know more about them. We've been pretty successful in publicising the dangers of accidental overdose, and clear information's given about the effects of taking these drugs long-term, so public awareness about increased tolerance levels is also gradually improving. Many doctors also now actively warn patients about the spiral of taking higher and higher doses for pain relief. Worryingly, though, I've seen cases where people on drug regimes for other conditions inadvertently take painkillers which add a potentially hazardous ingredient to the mix already in their system. This is something which needs urgent attention. I'd like now to talk about an osteoarthritic patient who was referred to me, a 30-year-old woman, let's call her Anne, suffering from sarcoidosis, an autoimmune disease leading to chronic organ inflammation. She was prescribed various drugs, but though the disease was soon brought under control, the pain lingered, with Anne gradually becoming dependent on prescription opioids. Typically, she was terrified of stopping them. Yet the more she took, the worse she felt. The thing is, her prescription would have been ideal for short-term pain, like that following surgery, but should never have been given for the chronic pain she was experiencing. And we all know that living with medication dependency has devastating consequences, not only on social well-being, but also on ability to function professionally, as was the case for Anne. She eventually went on long-term sick leave, as often happens in such cases. Thankfully, Anne's now much better. Having recognised her dependence, and with the necessary support, tools and techniques, she's now off painkillers. The crucial thing is to prevent dependence in the first place. Anne's GP prescribed opioids in good faith, aiming at pain reduction, but failed to set an end date for these. He hadn't anticipated the possibility of eventual drug reliance, this being new territory to him. Anne couldn't hide the visible results of the quantities she was eventually taking, so her GP questioned her about intake. She reluctantly admitted supplementing her prescription from sources like friends and family, something her GP had suspected but hadn't investigated. Anne now realises that drugs weren't fixing her problem, and though withdrawal took several tough months, her determination to succeed has paid dividends.
That is the end of Part C. You now have 2 minutes to check your answers. That is the end of the listening test.